Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Hey, it's John here. The podcast hasn't technically started yet. It'll be along in a minute, I promise. But before we get going, I just wanted to basically ask you all for a favour. You're all very nice people. You've all been listening to us enthusiastically, I hope. So now I want something in return. I'm not going to ask for money, don't worry. What I would like, though, is if you had 5 minutes to give us a nice review on iTunes and to tell your friends, because we'd like to get more people listening to this and we think you're the best people to help us do that. So go on, be nice, do us a favour. Anyway, that's the public service announcement over. I now return you to your normal podcast service.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello and welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm Barbara.
And I'm John. And this week we're talking about migration and urbanisation.
In 1970, it was about 1.5 million. Right now, it's about 21 million at least. We haven't had a census in like 10 years, so no one really knows. But there are a lot of people.
There's a long history of refugee camps taking root in Jordan. And I think with the refusal to allow them to build permanent housing in Zaatari is a way of preempting repeats of that situation.
Every true red-blooded American hates my city. And by my city, I mean Washington, D.C.
As we're recording this, we're about a week off a major day in British history. June the 23rd is our referendum on Brexit, whether we're going to remain part of the European Union. And I am personally pretty petrified about the whole thing. How are you feeling?
Yeah, pretty much the same. I think it's only now dawning how these polls probably do mean what they say when we are going to leave. We'll be the first country to do so. It will be disastrous. End of.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's we're going to sort of empower some of the least pleasant people in British politics. We're going to crash the economy. Sterling's going to go down. It's going to be enormous amounts of uncertainty for the however many million European citizens who are currently living in Britain quite legally at the moment, who may no longer be allowed to be here. Nobody seems to know that. It's generally, from my point of view anyway, a very bad thing. But we do seem to be on the minority side on this one, which is why we might be losing. In that, you know, we're obviously sort of, you know, metropolitan London types who are reasonably okay with immigration and a diverse society and so on. And a lot of the country doesn't seem to be with us on that one.
Yeah, well, it's a funny in that maybe you wouldn't anticipate that all referendums specifically would mirror that effect you get in elections of feeling like you're sitting in a city, everyone around you is kind of pretty cuddly liberal. But partially, I mean, the voting intention in the referendum is very, very linked to age. But also, as with everything, people with direct experience of migration in their community tend to be more pro-migration. That is just the trend. Mm. And so obviously cities are going to be sites of pro-EU sentiment.
The reason I'm bringing this up is I kind of think it speaks to this divide between urban and rural, this idea that cities are open, they're cosmopolitan, and they're also, they're kind of, psychologically speaking, closer to each other than they often are to their sort of rural hinterlands, I think.
But it's also, I think, self-sustaining because it's two completely different ways of life, really. The way you live in a city is very similar to the way that lots of other people in other cities live. But also you might have chosen to live there because that is a lifestyle that you like. And so it does kind of make sense that your priorities culturally or politically would be slightly defined by both those choices and that place where you live. When we talk about all these votes to do with kind of being part of a larger structure or cooperating or accepting difference or whatever, those are all things that do ring truer, I think, to people in cities because they have to do it every day and they're in very close proximity to everyone.
I guess that's the difference, really, that it's the difference between the place you're from and the place you move to. It's like, you know, the family you're born with or the family you choose.
Yeah, and there's kind of interesting studies into migrants in general, which would often be migrants who move to cities, in that they have something in them that makes them move somewhere, but then also the process of moving somewhere changes you, and then you are then in the end in a city, which is very different from living somewhere rural. So the fact that you've got these two slightly different archetypes developing, or which have developed over hundreds of years, sort of adds up.
I kind of feel like certainly in Western politics, this is increasingly the sort of most visible fault line. It's not necessarily between left and right. It's between open, liberal, cosmopolitan and a more traditionalist outlook that's kind of more rooted in nation and you know, traditional identities.
So are you going to say that London should secede? London should stay in Europe alone?
Well, let's see what happens next Thursday, shall we? I don't want to rule it out. There is a guy I know on Twitter who's fond of saying that the rest of the country keeps trying to save London from immigration, which I think is kind of, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Migration, by and large, is a process of urbanisation, isn't it? A lot of it is people moving to cities.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a job in a new country, I mean, the idea that you would go and kind of open a farm or kind of work in a rural area where there are already relatively few jobs, that doesn't quite add up unless you have a special skill which you are bringing, which would suit that area. But I mean, cities are hotspots of jobs, of quick and easy housing, and also an area being more international to start with, I think, is an attraction to you as an expat or a migrant, because you kind of have a sense that you will be accepted there, perhaps in a way you wouldn't be elsewhere.
Also, I suppose on the most basic level, in a city like London or New York or probably a few others, you can find people from your country. Wherever you're from, there will be people from your country there. Like, there's probably a few tiny ones, like maybe you'd struggle to find anyone from Monaco or something, I don't know, but generally speaking, we don't really have a huge San Marino community, but...
Not yet. No, I live in a very strong Turkish community, and it's kind of an amazing concentration. So actually, if you were looking outside Turkey for somewhere to live, London would be a pretty good option for you.
So I suppose that's the history of urbanisation generally, isn't it? It's people moving to cities in search of economic opportunities. And you know, that process is kind of, it's largely done in the West. None of our cities have grown by that much more than sort of population growth generally in 50 years or more. But in much of the world, you can still see that going on. So let's see how that looks in an emerging megacity.
This is a Brooklyn-bound A express train. The next stop is Dyckman Street. This is a 125th Street-bound A express train. The next stop is 59th Street, Columbus Circle.
My name is Emmanuel Akinwotu. I'm a journalist around Nigeria, mainly for The Guardian, and for other outlets too.
And you spend a lot of time in Lagos, which is, I think, one of the fastest growing cities in the world, is that right?
Yes, it is. In 1970, it was about 1.5 million. Right now, it's about 21 million, at least. We haven't had a census in, like, 10 years, so no one really knows. But there are a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, 21 million is big. That's, like, on any measure, that's a couple of Londons. So that's, like, about a third of the British population.
Yeah.
This is a lot of people in one city.
And you step off outside the airport when you get there, and you can more or less see that, I'm in a very highly densely populated place.
So if all that growth has come in, like, under half a century, what does that actually look like? I mean, in the most literal sense, like, what does a city that's kind of grown that rapidly look like? Is it a high-rise city? Is it slums? What are we talking about here?
A lot of slums. So from a housing perspective, I think by some measures, two-thirds of the inhabitants in the city live in informal housing settlements in slums, essentially. Just not enough homes. And a transport perspective, it's heavily congested. It's traffic. In terms of waste, there's so much waste. I think I read that there's something like 10,000 metric tons of waste. I'm not really a scientist, so I can't, you know, kind of finally put that down. But you get to Lagos and you realise there's a lot of waste around.
Can you smell it? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, you can in some places. That's one of the things that the successive governments have done better at, in making the smell in some sites a lot less bad. But you can see it everywhere you go. Waste is a massive problem, and these are the problems that really kind of are never ending, because population growth is not slowing at all.
So I have a sort of mental image of what a slum looks like, right. But that's garnered from films and,
cool.
And very important articles in the left-wing press. I don't know how accurate it is. Can you kind of tell us what a slum actually looks like and how it functions?
There's an informal housing settlement called Badia East in a place in Lagos called Jora. Imagine a kind of, not a dump site, but a kind of left-alone field. There's a lot of kind of grass coming out of rocks, kind of waste around, just a kind of wastelands, really. And people just build their informal housing on these lands. And that's like kind of shacks, that's kind of using kind of tin houses, scraps. Some people don't just have kind of makeshift shelters. It's essentially just like walking in one open house at points, you know, that's compartmentalized. Other people actually make more solid structures too, but you can sense that there is no sense of structure really. And a lot of these slums, obviously you have people just sleeping out in the open too. And that's because they're not land that's technically, it's not legally, it's private land. But there is so much of private land that's just not used, that's just there essentially, that people that can't afford housing, people that, you know, get evicted from their housing, essentially just migrate to these places and end up living there. And they become these kind of, you know, slums, if you like, over time. And it usually ends up in tears, because when the land is then, either the developer or state government or the private property, the owner then decides, you know, this might actually be somewhere where we'd like to build stuff on. It ends up leading to thousands of people being evicted from these places. Mm-hmm.
Do any of these slums ever become formalized? Do any of them end up just like any other settlement?
Badia East is a good example, because they'd been there since the 70s. You know, so this has been a kind of slum that's been there for like 40 years. Mm. About 30 years before the person who owned the land, this kind of traditional ruler, decided that, you know, it's time to kind of take what's mine. Although his claim to the land has since been disproven, I've heard. But essentially, when you have a settlement like this that's been there for 30 years, it very much can feel like a kind of semi-decent housing settlement of various kind of different-looking houses, a disparity between good and not-so-good ones. But it seems quite fixed. And for many of the people who live there, it's where they've lived there half their whole lives. So there is a sense of structure to it, even in the sense that you get salons around it, businesses that are built around it, youth centres. Badia East, for example, was formal to the point where the World Bank approved funding for there to be a Médecins Sans Frontières center there. There was a World Bank-funded school there. There was projects like that. So it was technically an informal settlement, but it had been there long enough for people to sort of just see it as where those people live, and it's sort of their home.
This isn't the whole picture. Like, Lagos also has the glittering central business district that's kind of one of the economic boom zones of Africa. Do you want to tell us about what does that look like?
Yeah,
is that kind of, really, is that sort of African Dubai?
Or? Yeah, it looks very beautiful. The thing is with housing in Lagos is most of the houses in Lagos have been built by individuals. Those individuals have built that house from scratch. Something like 95% of houses are built by individual house owners. And the kind of stencil is just a kind of coloured and usually like a blue or a brown soft coloured cement house, a few stories, and some of them look really quite stunning, especially a lot of the new ones in places like Lekki, Victoria Island. These are places on Lagos Island, which is across the way from the mainland. It's a much more affluent aspect part of Lagos. These developments have grown a lot, but in a way it's the story of housing in Lagos is that the supply far outstrips the demand in these areas. So you have a lot of these new homes that are kind of vacant because there are a lot of really beautiful, attractive homes, but there really aren't enough rich people in Nigeria to accommodate all of them. And then you have predominantly on the mainland, very, very few affordable housing relative to a population that need a lot more. Sadly, in terms of housing investment, it's more being put towards these really expensive, lush homes. A lot of high-rises now, not just on the island, on the mainland too. A lot of them are very expensive, you know, and a lot of them even are in and around slum areas. So, for example, Badia East, you have this large kind of informal slum area where there are thousands of people who live there informally. And you also have, at the edge of it, new housing development that is going to be targeted towards the very wealthy.
Do you think there is any sign of the growth of Lagos slowing? I mean, how big the... I'm kind of using Lagos as a sort of a talisman for this whole sort of new breed of cities, but like, how big can a city get, do you think? I mean, like, there's the, the population, there's a lot of people in Nigeria who could still move there, right?
Yeah, and migration to Lagos isn't slowing at all. It's something like 100,000 people, I think by some metrics, every week trying to come to the city.
I'd like to say at this point my jaw literally drops
when
that figure.
And in terms of how many people who move there, it's a magnet, it's a jobs magnet. That's one of the biggest draws. I saw last week the National Bureau of Statistics released a report where they said of all the online jobs in Nigeria in the last quarter of last year, almost half of them, 44% of them, were jobs applied for in and from Lagos. So if you were looking online for a job in Nigeria, most likely, almost half of those jobs were jobs that you'd have to go to Lagos to work in.
But 100,000 a week, that's like 5 million people a year. A city, surely it can't be growing.
No, it can't. It's not growing by that much in terms of the flow of people.
Sure. Yeah. So there's flow in the other direction.
Yeah,
as well,
of course. There are a lot of statistics. One of the statistical problems with talking about Lagos is there's so many reports out, and a lot of it is not commissioned by government, so they're like NGOs. But in terms of where we are as a population, I can't see how it's going to stop, and I can't see how the problems in the city are going to get any better, because essentially we need development, we need policy to kind of quicken, and it's so slow. It's so immaterial that the problems are growing much faster than the solutions are.
This is a Euclid Avenue bound F train via the A line. The next stop is Nostrand Avenue. This is a Brooklyn bound F train via the B line. The next stop is Grand Street.
So, of course, while that process of urban migration can be the result of people seeking out economic opportunities, it can also sometimes be less choice-driven and more driven by circumstance.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So let's hear from somewhere where that's very much the case.
Hi, I'm Olivia Cuthbert. I'm a freelance journalist living in Amman, Jordan. I'm particularly interested in focusing on issues affecting gender equality in the Middle East, and I've been also researching the refugee situation here in Jordan, and recently wrote a piece for City Metric on Zaatari refugee camp. In terms of the camp environment, what I noticed when I went up recently was that there seemed to be more signs of permanence. People have painted caravans and the street names, they've painted street names. You've got things like Garden Street and sad contradictions like that, but there was more colour, and people seem to be improving the environment on an aesthetic level, which indicates an acceptance of a longer stay and reinforces this sad idea of open-ended exile that they have to live with.
So in your piece for us, you wrote about how it's kind of a slightly controversial idea, I guess, that it is kind of a city. I think it's now the fourth biggest city in Jordan. But how should authorities kind of deal with that difficulty? Because obviously you want it to be as comfortable as possible while they are there, but you also don't want it to be seen as this permanent settlement where people are kind of stuck for a really long time.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the challenge, really, balancing this need for urban infrastructure in the immediate term to make the situation more manageable with the government's desire to prevent it from becoming a real lasting city in the long term, as has happened before with the Palestinian situation. there's a long history of refugee camps taking root in Jordan, and I think the refusal to allow them to build permanent housing in Zaatari is a way of preempting a repeat of that situation. But they do need to find affordable and sustainable ways of meeting the needs of the camp population. So that's why they've invested in a water network, a sewage system. There's a solar power plant that should be ready towards the end of the year, I think. And these are needed, really, to address the shortfalls in the camp at the moment and offer a more practical way of distributing resources. It'll also be cheaper in the long term, I think. As the conflict goes on, the funding will go down, so they really need sustainable solutions to the needs of the camp population, whether it's major infrastructure or smaller scale things like their community recycling projects underway. So I think these things aren't meant to be a sign of permanence, but looking ahead at the long-term implications of this investment, it's hard to imagine the Jordanian government not wanting to use these facilities in the long term. One possibility is that Zaatari will end up becoming an extension of the neighbouring city of Mafraq.
I mean, you hear a lot about how these areas are kind of almost urban or almost city-like, but you mentioned housing as one example of something that really signifies the impermanence, so they don't have formal housing at all. Are there other things that just kind of struck you as unfinished and made life quite hard living there?
I think one of the main problems that a lot of people face is boredom, actually. Mm. They've got very few people have jobs in Zaatari, or they've left their normal life routines and they're just living in limbo, waiting to go back to their own countries, not sure when, which is a very difficult thing to deal with, as you can imagine. But yeah, they've got these small caravans. You've got five odd people sharing a tiny space. There's nothing to do all day. People are frustrated by the situation. And I think another problem is that how this frustration can manifest itself. There's a big problem with domestic violence in the camp, and these small spaces, you know, exacerbate that issue. And having nothing to do, it makes it more of an issue than it otherwise would be, I think.
And it must cover quite a large area of land. Do people just walk around, or are there any kind of bikes or anything like that that people use?
No, transport around the camp is actually another of the problems that people living there face. I think it's an area of about 5 square kilometres, so it's pretty enormous. So yeah, I think people live within their districts, but I mean, in terms of accessing healthcare and schooling, the size of the camp's a real issue. And for women in particular, I think moving around the camp can be quite dangerous. Sexual harassment is a really big problem. The reason that some girls aren't allowed by their families to go to school is because it's too far to reach the schools from their homes, and they're at risk of harassment on the way. So yeah, the size of the camp and the lack of transportation is a real issue.
I mean, do you think that something like a minibus service or something could ever be a possibility, or?
Yeah, I mean, I presume that could solve it. I haven't heard it mentioned as an option. I think what they're actually doing is trying to create more schools and bring the services to the people rather than taking them to the schools and to the hospitals. That seems to be the approach.
So there's obviously a tension between the fact that you call these places cities, but actually they're defined by not having any freedom, of not being able to make choices or move around by yourself. So do you think that makes it a bit of a misnomer, really, when people talk about these places as cities?
Yeah, so I mean, you've got this urban environment evolving as new infrastructure is laid down. And if you look around Zaatari, it does have a lot of city characteristics. You've got the technical structures like the roads and the water, the electricity, and then you've got social infrastructure as well, with schools, you've got medical centres, and then smaller things like internet cafes, even pet shops. There's a market where you can buy everything from wedding dresses to water tanks. You know, people sell ice cream in the summer. So you've got all of these things that you wouldn't expect to find in a refugee camp, that you would find in a normal city. But as you say, the difference, of course, is in the restrictions. It's, at the end of the day, it's an artificial environment. You know, it's a refugee camp, and as long as it operates like a refugee camp and is controlled and managed in that way, it can never properly resemble a city. The environment itself, it's controlled. People there are heavily reliant on subsidised services and support. And then there's the freedom of movement, of course, is restricted. You can't, refugees in Zaatari, they're not allowed to enter or exit without a police permit if they violate the terms of that permit, which will cover a set period of time. I think it's 3 days. Then they'll face problems. You've also got the psychological imprisonment. People feel very trapped by not being allowed to leave when they want and by also not being allowed to work and improve their situation. And many will describe the caravans as cells. As mentioned, you know, they spend hours there each day bored with nothing to do, and that then leads to other problems. So I think, you know, you could say that it's a half-fledged city in a physical sense. It's evolving into a city from a structural point of view, but from a social perspective, it's been set up in response to this emergency situation, and the social and psychological environment is very much a reflection of that.
Now it's the part of the show where we hear from someone out there about their city. This week we're going to hear from a guy called Lyman Stone, who lives in Washington, D.C.
Every true red-blooded American hates my city. And by my city, I mean Washington, D.C. With more government employees than any other place in the nation, and the highest ratio of federal spending received to federal taxes paid, this city is everything my countrymen love to hate. Plus, it's cosmopolitan. Over 21% of the population is foreign-born, compared to just about 14% around the whole nation. Beyond that, D.C.'s city plan was laid out in the same time period and under the same principles as the redesigned Paris. Broad diagonal avenues slashing across an organized grid, which happens to have the same street names repeated four times across the city's four quadrants. In other words, the city is a beast to navigate for the millions of tourists who arrive and soon find themselves frustrated by how un-American the city's design is. But for all that, D.C. is growing. The metro area has seen steady growth for decades as the suburbs in Virginia and Maryland grow, but recent years have even seen a revival in the city center. I live right on Capitol Hill, one of the fastest gentrifying neighborhoods, and this growing population is fed by migrants like me. Less than a third of D.C. residents were born in D.C., one of the lowest rates of any locality in the nation, while 45% were born in other states. Everybody here knows that nobody is from here. The city's peak population was in 1950 at around 800,000 people. From then until around 2000, it declined to 570,000 people. As federal jobs moved out to Virginia and Maryland, infrastructure investments like the Beltway Road and the Metro made commuting much easier, local government became more and more incompetent, and crime got worse. D.C.'s collapse in population was one of the most severe among major U.S. cities, even as its crime rates was one of the highest. But since 2000, the city has grown again, with one of the strongest population recoveries of any major city in the U.S., gaining 100,000 people as of 2015. This growth has been led by greatly expanded federal employment under President Bush and President Obama. The housing crisis that drove many people out of expensive homes drove them into rented urban apartments. More people attended universities and graduate schools, and, well, if you believe the hype, which I'm not sure I do, young millennials have been moving in who want beautiful, historic, walkable neighborhoods, which abound in D.C. It remains to be seen if this growth will last. D.C.'s beautiful, almost Parisian skyline, with many low buildings and one prominent monument, is only maintained by aggressive zoning laws that drive housing prices way up. The quality of local government has only improved a bit. Crime is down, but there have been recent spikes again. And the very process that could lower prices, removal of height restrictions, could also destroy the aesthetics that attracted many migrants to begin with. So will DC's growth continue? Only time will tell.
A I should say that if you enjoyed that, then you should check out Lyman's own podcast, which is very on topic for us this week. It's called Migration Nation, and it's about the history of internal migration in the United States, and very good it is too.
So for our map of the week this week, we have a map from someone called Duncan Smith, who has basically plotted the different sizes of world cities over time since about 1950, but also projected to 2030. And the really interesting thing that you can see is how in maybe kind of Western Europe, you get these kind of big cities, which are very large in kind of the 50s. But then as time goes on, you can see all those cities in the rest of the world kind of catching up and in fact overtaking those European cities, which kind of is the story of the world economy over that period, I guess.
Yeah, well, this is one of those times it'd be really useful if we weren't on radio here. But, you know, style it out. One of the things that I think is so effective about this map is you can see the different phases of urbanization over time because the color scheme uses lighter colors for later dates. So the European and Eastern North American cities, they've all done all their growth by 1950, but there's another generation of cities behind them, places like Tokyo or Osaka, and then there's the sort of emerging megacities of India and China coming up behind them. And you can just see it in one glance. You can basically see the whole history of urbanization for the past 80 years or more. It's a really impressive piece of work, actually, which we're doing no justice to, so you'll just have to check it out online. You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by John Elledge and Barbara Speed and produced by Royfield Brown. Our theme music is Dust from the Stars by Charlie Charles. You also heard The Weather by Destinazione Altrove and Embryonic Waves composed by Matthew Whitehill. All music in the show was licensed under Creative Commons. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast and on iTunes, where you'll also find two more shows by our excellent colleagues, Seriously and the New Statesman podcast. In the meantime, you can find all the stories about cities, maps and geography you could possibly want on our website, citymetric.com. You can also talk to us on Twitter and on Facebook, where there's a pretty good chance we'll talk back. And if you wanted to leave a review to tell your friends how lovely we are, well, we'd very much appreciate that. Thanks for listening.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
지하 서울역입니다. 내리실 문은 오른쪽입니다. 명동.